Birth, Volume 3, The Gathering, Chapter 13. "Oh my God, Shelley, are you all right? I heard about the attack," said the station manager. "I'll be okay with some makeup," said Shelley, trying to get past him without much more conversation. "We sent out a bulletin. It's not like there's regular programming out there, but people missed you. We want to make sure, you know," he said. "Look, I have no explanation. I don't know why I'm here and Orphan is gone. We should both be dead. That son of a bitch was after me, and they killed him," she said, beginning to cry. "Oh, Shelley, please don't cry. Please, please. We cover death every day somewhere in the world. It sucks so bad when it's close to home. But we are in the news business. We have to tell the story. That's what we do. People are counting us to do it and not lose our cool. What would Abdullah say?" he asked, holding her shoulders and not offering to hug or console her. "Oh, thanks, boss. For a minute I thought you cared," said Shelley, fighting to stay strong. "Yeah, well, I do. You know that. Now, suck it up and get some makeup on. And do those things need to stay on there?" he said, pointing to the starry strips over her right eye. "They're like superglued. Yeah, they stay on there. We'll pull my hair down or something. You mind?" she said, trying to break his grip on her shoulders. "Break a leg, Shelley," said the station manager. "It's not like you could fire me, asshole," she said, walking toward the makeup booth set up in the lobby of the communications floor in Building E. "Okay, you have to stop coming in here like this," said the makeup artist. "Well, people keep trying to kill me," said Shelley. "I heard." "What, do you think I don't watch the news?" quipped the makeup artist. "Just do your best. Leave those on there. Better than stitches, right?" said Shelley, looking in the mirror at the back of the table set up on the vanity. "I had those once on my chin. You're right. No scar. Okay, let's see what we can do," he said, wiping some base onto her forehead. Within a few minutes, she was ready for the camera. She checked with the camera operator to make sure the script was loaded into the prompter, and she sat in the anchor chair, trying not to scratch the itch on her cheek. She thought about the manager's words, that they were professionals, and remembered the words from the Don Henley song, "Dirty Laundry." "She can tell you about the plane crash with a gleam in her eye," she sung softly. She tried her whole life not to be that bubble-headed bleach blonde. She recalled her traffic reporting days when they had tried to follow the black helicopter leaving Pasadena and ended up almost colliding midair with a Gulfstream jet that was running from Hellfire missiles. She remembered the car crash in the hospital where her hero, Orphan, saved her life twice. "He was such a good boy," she said softly. "No, he was a man. He talked like a man and fought like a man, and she was falling in love with him." She could feel the concussion from where the drone exploded again in her mind. It was a blur up there somewhere. That soldier wouldn't let her look, and he covered her face with a sheet. "Okay, world," she said to the abandoned camera lens. Then she thought of Abdullah. She could see his dark, warm eyes looking at her while he blew out a cigar smoke over his custom-made penthouse office desk. "You are my best long-term investment, Shelley LaSalle," he would say. "People need one face and one voice to tell them the story that will save their souls. You are that person, Shelley," he said one night after they had talked about his wife and his oldest son. He had sent him back to Iraq to live with his uncle because he would not obey his father. She slid up straighter in the seat with the memory of how much trust he had placed in her. "I never had a daughter," he said. She knew exactly what he was saying. She would be like Orphan. She would love Abdullah without question and follow his guidance. 5 minutes, Shelley," said the producer from between his headphones, wired to the soundboard behind him. "Okay, I'm just going over things in my mind," she said, reaching into her portfolio for the paper notes for the broadcast. She noticed the corner of it had been scraped, and it smelled a little like smoke. "I got this," she said quietly. She took a few breaths like Lorraine had taught her. trying to blow the negativity out of her. The hangover feeling sat in her stomach, but tonight she would speak from the heart. 5, 4, 3, said the producer with his fingers counting off the next 2 seconds and the red light coming on top of the camera. Hello, everyone. I'm Shelley LaSalle. First, the news. The coastal cities in most countries have been evacuated, and some rogue waves have been filmed by the few remaining weather satellites striking Florida, Shanghai, the Yucatan region, and both coasts around the Aleutian Islands. Earthquakes are almost nonstop now, although they appear to be far worse in our southern hemisphere. Colored ribbons of plasma now fill both night and daytime skies. I encourage you to remain in shelters as much as possible, especially south of Mexico City. I'm afraid that is not all we have to prepare for. There are reports that troops and equipment have been gathering for a major assault against the Earth. I am told that all broadcasts have been blocked on the temporal Earth, so please follow these instructions as best you can. President Riker is not preparing to fight them. As Commander-in-Chief, he has crafted a different defense. The two Earths are vibrating at different frequencies, mostly because of you. Your loving thoughts, your mercy and charity for one another is shifting the energy of our planet. The other world is still made of rock and metal, but it is not like this world. When things from that world are brought here to this world, they lose the ability to remain whole. They slowly fall apart. Their ships cannot land. Their troops cannot face you. They cannot wage a war on the ground here. But they can, and will, wage a war from the air. In fact, they plan to attack from orbit. They will start with the large cities first. But remember this, my dear friends. They cannot win unless they make us fearful. I know how delicate life is, she said with her throat beginning to close. She paused for a moment and forced the tears to stop welling in her eyes. These few months, I have been preparing you with these words, given to me by a great man who knows this is true, she said, not reading the script any longer. The producer turned around and faced the soundboard, and he held his hands up to stop rolling the script until she returned to it. I am asking you to have no fear. I know that sounds easy, but it is not. I know you were told these stories of how you might be taken off the earth while this terrible destruction fell upon it, but those were words that were added to the scriptures to deceive you into thinking that members of your tradition were somehow better than everyone else. You're not. I'm not. Physical death will come to every person. But I promise you that if you will go out past that death and look back at it from the spirit side, you will see how simple it is. Our mortal lives are the most powerful expression of our souls possible. We are challenged and disappointed. We attempt and fail. But we get to love one another. We get to create life in our own image. We get to walk the most beautiful planet in the universe for a few brief moments. But there is another force out there that does not want this for you. They need you to be afraid. They need you to hate. They need you to seek after revenge. Do not let them win. This beautiful living planet with all the variety of life is going home. You are going with it. The dark armies of the other world are coming soon to keep you here in this orbit with that cold world of desolation. She looked up at the camera operator and back down at the teleprompter screen in front of the lens. The producer turned around again to the board operator and drew circles in the air for him to restart the script. The president has ordered the military to full alert to assist you with all its personnel, equipment, and resources. If you see a man in uniform, he is ours. If you see any equipment, They are there to help. If you need supplies or assistance, put out a white flag, a towel, or a bed sheet, and help will come to you. Make your way to higher ground as long as you have shelter. Remember to boil your water and then filter it with charcoal. If you don't have a filter, one will be provided for your community. There is no need to hoard food or supplies. No one will go hungry, and no one will be left behind. The president recommends that you divide up the tasks and specialize so that everyone has a place to sleep, clean water to drink, and sufficient meals for each day. We are not sure how much longer electricity will be available, so preserve foods by canning or smoking. There is someone in every community that knows how to do this, so share that knowledge. You may notice people missing from your cities and communities, shrinking as the two worlds complete their separation. If you can hear my voice, you are in the right place. Don't be afraid. Look for the good in other people and help it grow. We are not going to war with anyone. Never again. Until tomorrow, this is Shelley LaSalle, saying peace to you all and good night. And we're out, said the producer, taking his headphones off. You had me scared there for a little bit, said the station manager. It's not like we have a hard break coming. I felt like I needed to add a few more words, said Shelley. Yeah, okay, but what did you mean? Asked the station manager. You meant the part about not giving in to hatred, she asked. No, the part about the bad guys coming to bomb us from orbit, said the station manager. The president mentioned it during one of our meetings. The people needed to know, or they will shatter like a dinner plate dropped on the floor, she said. Okay, but I wasn't really afraid before, and now I am, said the station manager. Yes, you are, but now you have time to deal with it. You have time to prepare. I'm trying to get people to realize that death is not forever, just like life is not forever, said Shelley. When I was a kid, it felt that way. But as I got older, I realized that life is too short. It's not all about work, 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 and then you die. I started to stop and look around once in a while, said the station manager. You remember in journalism school when they asked you if you would want to know the day of your death? What you answered? She asked him. Yeah, I guess. I said no. But then later in my life, I thought it would be nice to know. You know, there are no loose ends, said the station manager. Well, if you have any loose ends, you might want to go tie them up, said Shelley as she slipped her notes back into her portfolio. I gotta go. I have a date with some mint tea. Hey, Shelley, he said, putting his hand on her arm. She paused and looked at him with a half smile. You were great. You really do a great job, and I love being around you. Thanks, boss. There's no place I would rather be. Thank you, she said, looking into his eyes. The crew emptied out faster than usual, probably due to the late hour at which they got started. It was quiet in the makeshift studio as she made her way to the elevator and rode it to the ground floor alone. She wondered about the president. Safely tucked away hundreds of feet below that building. Tea with a friend was a treasure compared to being sequestered deep underground, but the loss of Orphan and her life left a chasm inside of her. She reached inside her purse and pulled her black silk mask over her head as she approached the door soldier. He opened the door and got the attention of the cart driver at the curb, who quickly unplugged the vehicle and slid into the driver's seat. It was a short ride to Building A, and in almost routine fashion now, she took off her head covering and stuffed it into her purse. She took the elevator up to the dining floor and walked into the kitchen where Chef Bailey and Lorraine were sitting quietly. "Am I late?" she asked them both. A princess is never late, said the chef, smiling, and placing a clean teacup and saucer onto the table in front of an empty chair. That was a powerful broadcast, Shelley, said Lorraine, smiling. I kind of ad-libbed some of it. I never know if it connects with people out there. We don't have ratings to go by anymore, said Shelley. Oh, believe me, it connected. There is only one place the world turns now for that message. It gets translated into 120 different languages on the fly by computer in your voice. It's really quite amazing, said Lorraine. So, what do we do now? I mean, do we just wait for the ships to come and start bombing? Asked Shelley. Not exactly. The Joint Chiefs are empowered to implement a space defense plan. We can't put manned stations along the Antarctic because the plasma has created a no-man's land down there. We can't deploy men above the Arctic because the winter is upon it, and the temperatures are 80 below, said Lorraine. So we're going to fight them in space? Asked Shelley incredulously. No one knows how to do that. But our resident genius has designed a system that is quite simple, said Lorraine. It doesn't sound simple. How does it work? Asked Shelley. Well, he calls it Operation Gravel Road, and I'm sure the Joint Chiefs will hear about it in an hour or so, said Lorraine. This is mint tea of my own concoction, said Chef Bailey, pouring her cup full. And you have to try one of these almond tea cakes, said Lorraine, sliding the plate over to her. Oh my God, is that lemon? Asked Shelley, letting a bite melt around the crunchy roasted almond slices. Real lemon, indeed. It's a perfect conflict of tastes with the mint in the tea, said the chef, pinching his fingers together off his lips. Are you married, Chef Bailey? Asked Shelley, taking a sip from her teacup. Oh, my good-looking girlfriend went home years ago, said the chef. Oh, I'm so sorry, said Shelley. Oh, don't be. She passed quietly in her sleep, and actually I feel pretty close to her right now, he said with a soft smile. Yeah, I think I know what you mean, said Shelley, looking at Lorraine. We'll be back here at 11 tonight. I'd love it if you joined us, said Lorraine. It's not like we don't have enough good things to eat, said the chef. I'll be here, as long as the dress code is casual, said Shelley. Come in your jammies for all I care, said Lorraine, finishing her tea. I have to go. Joint Chiefs are waiting to be astonished. See you tonight, said Chef Bailey, kissing her on the cheek. Thanks again, Lorraine. I learned something today, said Shelley. So did I. The world cannot be without you, said Lorraine, hugging her shoulder and walking out of the door. Another tea cake? Asked the chef. Oh, yeah. I don't even know what happened to the first one, she said, smiling as she picked up another one off the plate. I'd like to think that these little cakes are partly responsible for world peace, said the chef. You said a mouthful, said Shelley, sipping her tea. Lorraine had grown up feeling that she was somehow connected to the planet itself. She studied to become a druid, but the training of a bard was intense and lasted for many years. Although her roots were Scottish, she chose the method recorded in Ireland, which lasted for 12 years. She passed quickly through the beginning ranks of Olaer to poet's attendant, a Tom Hahn, and through her apprenticeship called the Drizack. She quickly mastered the grammar, the mandatory 20 stories, and the Ogham tree alphabet. Then she had to get a real job and discovered she had a strong talent for organizing companies into efficient and effective co-ops of sorts. Forming a company was as easy as filing paperwork, but making it function like its own little ecology was where she excelled. For the next 4 years, she began her college training. She mastered 10 bardish stories each year, 100 Ogham combinations, 12 philosophy lessons, and a small library of poems all about nature and its relationship to humans. There were complex diphthongal combinations, the law of privileges, and the uses of grammar that let her hardwire a very unique way of thinking and feeling. She reached the rank of pillar, called a clee, and continued to grow her library of poems and stories about trees growing, birds migrating, and even mushrooms moving across the forest floor season by season. It was all important and organized for a reason. She had several instructors that knew the writings, but they didn't have the talent. So she pushed herself, in less than a year, to achieve the level of noble stream called Anruth, and she mastered more than 350 stories and tales of nature, finally earning her the title of Olmamh as a doctor of poetry. She still had her golden branch, which she had hanging on her office wall. She could tell any one of 1,000 stories, but more importantly, she could recognize the Creator's writing in other traditions as well. Although the community liked to think of worshiping the earth itself, she had always known that it was a living thing that was designed to form a symbiotic relationship with the beings living upon it. It was a life form of its own, but equally as noble as the humans living on it. One did not worship it. One revered it, just like any other life form. As she rode up the elevator back in Building E for the third time in one day, she imagined the ignorance of the Joint Chiefs. They had chests full of metals, but they did not understand the simplest things about how the earth worked. She was afraid of them at first, but she soon realized it was they who were afraid of her. She had no intention of playing that card, but it was refreshing to see their respect, even if it was while holding their fingers in the form of a cross while she spoke. "Good evening, Kyle, Rhino," said Lorraine as she walked into the reception office in front of the conference room. "Hi. We decided to come a little early. I hope you don't mind," said Kyle. "No, not at all. I think we have about 15 minutes before we start. Do you have any questions?" asked Lorraine. "No, not really. It just feels weird getting ready to talk to the guys from Wars R Us," said Kyle. "Oh, that's cute," said Lorraine. "Well, it's true. They have a planned response for everything, and it usually begins with an air assault," said Kyle. "Not today." "That's why you're here," said Lorraine. "Dick always said I was a very dangerous man, but I don't think he had this in mind," said Kyle. "It's a good thing you're a counterpuncher," said Lorraine. "I think of it more like a kung fu master," said Kyle, smiling and holding his hands in the form of blades. "I think you were a chess master," said Rhino, fist-bumping Kyle. "That's what I'm talking about. No muscle required, right?" returned Kyle. "You demand, Kyle," said Rhino, smiling. "Well, here's the president. It's good to see you, Mr. President Hadid," said Lorraine. "It's good to come up out of the hole," said Riker. "Hello, Mr. President," said Kyle and Rhino together. They both shook hands with Riker and with Hadid. "You guys ready for this?" asked Riker. "I don't know enough to be ready or not ready, so let's get it on," said Kyle. "Don't be scared. You have the Commander-in-Chief on your side. Let's go," said Riker, motioning for Hadid to open the door for them to enter the room. The Joint Chiefs were long used to Hadid entering the room first. His eyes saw everything and watched every hand. He was solely dedicated to protecting the president's life, and he had already been involved in a firefight with one of the members of this group of leaders, where General Cabarrus was killed by a single blow from Rhino's concrete punch to the side of his head. They were all on the same side, but they knew they would never be fully trusted. Hadid took his position with his back against the wall and his hands behind him, inches away from his service weapon. "Good evening, generals, admiral," said Riker. "Good evening, Mr. President," they said in unison. "Be seated, please. Remove your jackets if you wish. You know my chief of staff. This is Kyle Kramer, and Rhino, you may recall from college football fame," said Riker, with the men extending their hands to shake. "I saw that 49ers game. My son was playing for Navy that year," said Admiral Donetti. "I miss it, but I like geophysics more," said Rhino, sitting on the two chairs on the opposite side from them. "Okay, Lorraine, would you take us forward?" asked Riker, loosening his tie and unbuttoning the top button on his white shirt. "Gentlemen, I have invited Mr. Kramer here to share his unique talent with you in consideration of the interspace challenge we discussed at our meeting," she began. "We have had some ideas on that," said General Smart of the Air Force. "Well, before you share those ideas, I want you to hear what Mr. Kramer has to offer. It might save you some political capital," said Lorraine, still standing. She waited for a few painful seconds and then used her hand to silently turn the floor over to Kyle. "You can call me Kyle, sirs," he said. "What do you have for us, Kyle?" said General Smart. "Okay, well, if I could use this whiteboard and a couple of markers, I could show you my idea," he said as he pushed his chair to the side and grabbed the black and blue markers from the tray. "This is the two planets coming apart. You could see we're still kind of connected here at the top of their world and the bottom of ours. Now, this blue circle is the moon, stuck down here on the lower world. It is not going to make this trip with us. By the way, that has some other effects Rhino can address as well, but anyway, this red pin represents the plasma zone. No ships can make it through there without becoming pretty much zapped. So that means the ships have to come way out here," he said, drawing dotted lines away from the equator zone of the lower planet to the Arctic region of the upper planet. "They could drop into orbit somewhere up here, but they really can't drop any bombs or missiles until they get down around here and slow down to around 18,000 miles an hour. Otherwise, they'll skip out into space and won't bother us too much. Okay, here's the deal. I call it Operation Gravel Road. We deploy road gravel here, here, and here in orbit around the higher Earth. It will stay there for about 2 to 3 years without any problem," he said. "Son of a bitch. I mean, that makes a gravel road in space," growled Marine General Bainberry. "Yeah. I mean, why launch anything at their ships when they will be flying at over 20,000 miles an hour already? The kinetic energy in a pebble is what took Goliath out, right?" asked Kyle. "And a hell of a lot cheaper than those high-tech space shotguns you guys were working on," said Admiral Donetti. "But it's a little like throwing sand in a street fight, but it works," said Bainberry. "There's a little more, sirs, if I may. We can't hide out here in the plasma zone, but we can use it as a sand trap, if you know what I mean. That's why we should take an old EA-6B tactical jamming system and deploy some of them to the moon," said Kyle, fiddling with the markers in his nervous hands. "I have a field of those things from our old prowlers," said Admiral Donetti. "Yeah, well, you can remove them from the planes and put them on aluminum frames and then set them on the far side of the moon, and you can cover this area here and here. That way their ships can't detect the gravel clouds, and they'll fly right into them," said Kyle. "Well, I will say this, it's a simple way to turn a slaughter into a pretty bad crapshoot," said Bainberry. "Are there any problems with getting this started right away?" asked Riker. "We'll have to use the equatorial launch sites from the French, but I really don't see any problem here," said General Smart. "We can use the X-37B to deploy and then reuse the craft. Let's make it happen. Let me know if you need anything." "Thank you, gentlemen," said Riker, standing up to leave with Hadid.